rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today we're asking one of the biggest and most baffling questions in football, one that has had even the brightest philosophers completely stumped. How good is Scott McTominay? We'll also be talking about Arsenal, West Ham, Luton, Sheffield United, and I'll be shoehorning in a mention of Lincoln City after super Brennan Johnson gave Tottenham a late winner against Brighton. And joining me, Tom Clark, for all of that, we have London football writer and European football expert Tom Allnutt, esteemed football writer and resident Fox expert Alison Rudd, and a former footballer who, during his 15 caps for Scotland's under-21s, never had anyone ponder how good he was. They knew he was absolutely class. Gregor Robertson is here too. You thought I was going to be mean then, didn't you?
Yeah. Good finish to that one.
good save. Now, we will be heading to the London Stadium very shortly, but first, last week it was Foxes. This week, Alison Rudd is waving a Jilly Cooper novel in my face. Why?
Because I was walking down my local high street and a woman who I don't really know, but is a friend of a friend of a friend, she stopped me and she said, "Oh, I was so impressed. You're a character in a Jilly Cooper novel." And I said, "I'm not a character, I'm a real person," which is a slightly odd response, but that's how I reacted. And she said, no, you're in a Jilly Cooper novel." So I was intrigued. So I bought the latest Jilly Cooper, which is called Tackle, which is about the world of football, steamy sex and football. And she uses our very own Johnny Northcroft as a consultant on what football journalists are like when they go in mix zones and press conferences and things. So it's perfectly acceptable, I think, for her to use Johnny Northcroft as a character, if you like, someone who appears in a press conference, a fictional press conference, and says something. But I was never consulted about the book. And I appear, I'll read it, you see why I'm so cross. I appear in this book.
Right? You're actually in this.
I'm in this book. I appear at a press conference just after the big team have won, but their star player isn't there. And so at the press conference, people are saying, you know, what's happened to him? And the chairman announces that he's just had his first child on a Saturday morning and he's called him Teddy. And I apparently say in a press conference, "As Teddy's a Saturday child," called out Alison Rudd from the Sunday Times, "he'll have to work hard for a living. I mean, I would never say anything so pathetic. I wouldn't quote, you know, "Wednesday's child is full of grace." I wouldn't do all that rubbish. And I was so annoyed. Of all the things the only female sports writer she puts in her novel could say, it's a stupid thing about Saturday's child working hard for a living. I was livid.
Sounds very accurate.
This makes a lot more sense. Just before we started recording, Alison Rudd told me to F off, which she's never actually done in the entire time I've known her. But now it makes more sense. It's all Jilly Cooper's fault. Well, we're going to have to ask Johnny about this, aren't we, Gregor, Thursday when he's in his starring role in Jilly Cooper's Fame and Fortune. But anyway, Alison, let's move on. Let's get you talking about more happy things. Let's talk about your actual journalism. Because you were at the London Stadium for Arsenal against West Ham. An extraordinary result for both sides. And again, as I always like to do on a Monday, quoting you back at you, just, you know, boost that ego a little bit after that knock that Jilly Cooper gave you. You say in your report today, "Right now, the chances of Arsenal capitulating in a thrilling title race appear very slim." Indeed, words I never thought I would hear you say about a Mikel Arteta side.
Well, that was on Sunday. I mean, on Sunday, everyone felt like that, didn't they?
You're over it now.
It's only when you sleep on it, you think, it doesn't mean anything.
You're over it now.
I thought you were going to quote my pigeon analogy, but there we go.
How do you know I've not got lined up?
Okay.
Might be coming later on. Anyway, tell us about the football. God's sake, you egomaniac.
From my point of view, it was slightly unexpected. I've seen Arsenal play badly in London derbies, and I've made the point in the past that it's extra hard for Arsenal to win the title because they have so many London derbies to navigate. which is difficult. It's an added hurdle. So, and West Ham had beaten them in the league this season. They'd beaten them in the EFL Cup. And you felt when the London Stadium, believe it or not, it can rock. When they're up for a team like Arsenal visiting, I thought this is going to be tricky for Arsenal. They might be gliding it a bit after their result against Liverpool. West Ham doing reasonably well in the league, even though David Moyes seems to get consistent stick regardless of where they are in league position terms. So I was expecting it to be at least competitive. When I'm writing on the whistle, I always like a little panic attack. I have a panic attack about everything, by the way. You know, what colour
including,
my shoes.
Including Jilly Cooper.
Jilly Cooper, yeah. My foxes, whatever. But I had, after sort of three or four minutes in, I'm thinking, oh, this is going to be tricky to write a lot of words about. Nothing's happening. This is going to be quite boring. But I was impressed with how Arsenal... I felt that Arteta had sort of made sure the team were mentally prepared for a feisty performance and they were not going to divert from their pattern. They were going to be very grown up and mature, and they were. And they started to create really quite beautiful chances. Areola made some good saves. Leandro Trossard, I think, is a underrated player who doesn't get enough minutes, but he started and was absolutely superb. And then there came a 15-minute spell. Before that 15-minute spell where Arsenal scored four goals, West Ham looked like potentially they could be decent on the break if they applied some intelligence and supported each other slightly better, but they weren't able to do that. And Arsenal were just, I mean, they were impressive, and I gushed about them in my report, Tom, because they did, for those, at least for those 15 minutes and probably for longer, they had everything.
Mm.
So they were aerially dominant. They were tactically dominant. They were aesthetically 100%. In everything they did, physically, athletically, with their intelligence, I mean, they scored their 8,000th league goal, and it was a very beautiful curling shot from Trossard. It was in that moment you thought they are worthy of being title winners because they were the complete team.
Can I just ask something really quickly?
Because
you referenced it in your piece. Is the London Derby thing really a thing?
It is, because
it's always
referenced.
You see, someone's not won in like 10 London Derbies, or like they have one Derby. Like, there's so many of them. Is it really?
They're graded. So some mean more than others. I would say the visit of Tottenham to the London Stadium gets the crowd going more than the visit of Arsenal. But they do care.
Chelsea don't
like Chelsea. Yeah. But Fulham going there is less of an issue for West Ham. But London clubs will raise their game when they face each other. And it's always the smaller club puts in a performance that annoys the bigger club. That's why it matters to someone like Arsenal.
Okay.
Tottenham have a particular problem because Chelsea, West Ham and Arsenal
are
number one, right?
Yeah.
Well, we'll come on to Tottenham later. Tom, when it comes to Arsenal, the team that you cover and report on for us, how significant is this win and the kind of the statement of it following on from that Liverpool performance?
I think it's significant in the sense that it really gives them a huge momentum boost at the moment. I think on the back of that Liverpool win, there was a lot of talk about them being overexcited. You know, the celebration kind of discussion obviously came back to the fore. And I actually thought, I don't know, Alisson kind of felt like this, but watching them kind of, they were so in control in this match. And that's why kind of the London Derby factor kind of comes into it, because it was the kind of game that if West Ham would wanted to kind of make it a scuffle and make it sort of heated, and that very much would have suited them. But actually, for Arsenal to kind of make it a technical contest, to make it a battle of skills, I think was always going to favour them, clearly. So they had the control, they kept it calm, they took the sting out of the match. And actually, I thought that was quite impressive, you know. And when you look at teams like City, that's what they do. You know, they don't want to get involved in a fisticuffs. You know, they want to keep everything very under control. And I think there was some validity in the kind of talk about their celebrations and getting overexcited, because we know that last season what kind of was one of their downfalls was that it all just felt like it got very tense and emotional for them. And I think actually if we're talking about Arsenal learning from last season in terms of the kind of the pressure of a title race, not only do I think this season they're much better off kind of lingering off the shoulder in that kind of third place, but I also think it kind of shows that they have maybe learned something. That said, I do think there's an asterisk, and I think the West Ham are all at sea at the moment, and they're in a bit of a state. And I think, you know, we can't say one week that Arsenal need a striker and they can't win the league without a better centre forward, and the next week say, well, look, they've beaten West Ham 6-0. You know, this team is ready to win the title. I do think there's something in between there, and you can beat a bad West Ham team that defended terribly and just, for some reason, since Christmas, just really haven't got going under Moyes. And those issues can still be at play when they're playing against slightly better sides. But no doubt, I think Arsenal are right in the race.
Speaking of David Moyes, who wore the expression of someone who finds the morning crossword so tricky he has to switch to counting pigeons on the back lawn, quote Alison Rudd. There you go, got the pigeons one in. I'll be happy now. Is it the contract thing, do you think? Is that actually a factor? Because I partly look at it and think, well, they've had the Moyes contract thing before. The kind of David Moyes at West Ham has always been an uncertain future. Gregor, they're a club that you've followed a lot last season in particular. Can we, you know, to Tom's point, the idea that they were playing quite well before Christmas, beat Arsenal, of course, and now can suddenly get thumped in fairly embarrassing fashion. Is it the uncertainty around Moyes?
I don't think so, no. I think it's losing Paqueta and losing Kudus for a large period of the last number of weeks. They're just huge for them. They produce moments in games that won them games or give them something to hold on to in games.
But they wouldn't have necessarily stopped them losing 6-0, though, or the defensive mistakes.
No, I mean, I don't know. I don't think you can explain this. I've really struggled to think of a time when I've seen a team defend so passively. There was a moment early in the game when Trossard flicked a header over the bar. Yeah. That was the end of it. But Arsenal progressed through the pitch without a West Ham player getting within even 10 yards of them. And it eventually came to Saka out wide. And again, like, Emerson was like, you know, down as if he was engaging Saka. But he was 10 yards away. Saka just cut inside, curled it in. There was no one near Trossard either. It was extraordinary. My jaw was on the floor. No one. And then Saka's goal, when he just sort of drifted inside Agard. And like, again, in the penalty box by this point, and no one's within 5 or 10 yards of him. It was extraordinary. And I don't think... I don't know. West Ham, we know West Ham set up to be rigid and to close space and to sit in a kind of defensive, you know, pretty rigid block. But usually when a team advances, then that's when they go and close. Even when Arsenal went to kind of, were probing and find the spaces, like in the final third, there was no bite, there was no anything.
You were asking Alison before about London derbies and do they matter? Why does a 6-0 matter so much? Why does a thrashing matter any more than if they'd lost 3-0 but played badly?
Well, it just heaps the pressure on you. It makes the mood extremely glum now.
Does it make you feel that much worse as a player if you've lost 6 versus, say, 3 or 4? You know, if you've lost 3 or 4 against the team in form...
Yeah, 6 is embarrassing. It's like...
It heads into... When do we tick into embarrassment territory? 5?
4.
Well, the West Ham fans decided it was 4.
Yeah.
Because that's when they left. Right.
Is that when the mood changed?
Yeah.
And speaking of mood, boos for Declan Rice. It's a bit embarrassing, isn't it?
Boos for Declan Rice.
I thought that I saw
most
something
of the time. Most of the time, they were very lovely to him, yeah. And Arteta thanked the West Ham fans for the respect they showed him. He got when he took his first corner. Oh, and suddenly Declan Rice takes everything, doesn't he? Set piece wise, but he took his first corner. The fans at that end of the pitch were all applauding him very, very warmly. I mean, there was nothing. I didn't feel there was anything but love for him. And when he scored, I've no relationship to West Ham or Arsenal. I don't have family members who are in love with either club. And yet I felt emotional when he scored because I could instantly picture what it must feel like to be a West Ham fan when a player who was so important to your team and gone on to better things, and nobody really was angry about him moving to Arsenal. It was felt like it was the correct progression for him, but there was just something terribly poignant about the elegance of his goal and how and embarrassing how easy it was for him and how influential he'd been in the match. And I actually felt emotional, like Munchausen style, on behalf of the West Ham fans. I imagine a lot of them weren't angry. I think they probably felt quite upset.
I think Tom's right, though. You can extrapolate a bit too much from these games. It wasn't a battering before the first goal went in. And then the first three goals were set pieces, which we've spoken about before, and Arsenal are so dominant. And then Trossard curls in an absolute beauty, and it's like, woof, just in the game has completely turned and gone for West Ham. And from that point, they collapsed. So
again, it would have been, honestly, it probably would have been 8, maybe 9, had Arteta not taken off most of his best players.
Really, it felt like one of those.
Yeah, he hauled off everyone who was getting 8 or 9 out of 10 on the 67th minute. And that was the message that we don't need to go at this so much now. 6-0's fine.
I think it's interesting what you're saying, Gregor, about the sort of passivity, you know, because I do wonder if, you know, that kind of approach that Moyes has, we know that in these big games he's going to kind of drop off, you know, and let the other team kind of have the ball. And I think there is a fine line. I can imagine in the change room before a match, if you have a manager who says to you, right, we're going to drop deep, frustrate them, play on the counter-attack. You can imagine that in the players' heads, that's a very different thing to a manager who says, right, we're going to press high, go at them from the first whistle, try and steal the ball in their final third. And I wonder if you just can quite easily stray into that thing where I'm dropping off, I'm letting them have the ball, and actually you can give them too much space. And I think West Ham fans, even when they're winning in the first half of the season, would say they've seen this performance coming for a long time, you know, because even though they haven't got hammered and humiliated like this, I think there've been
hammered, very good.
There have been a lot of performances. I mean, I was there at Bournemouth a few weeks ago, and they were really poor, you know. And they drew 1-1, but there was no zip, no plan. It felt like they were just relying on moments, you know. And I think it's been like that for a while. And yes, you know, Moyes obviously has done a great job in terms of the memories and the moments. But I think week to week, if you're a West Ham fan and you're watching these games, there's not a lot of joy there, you know, and sometimes those victories are kind of okay because the results justify it. But as soon as the results go, you know, we've seen this so many times with these kind of managers that are slightly more cautious. As soon as the results go, there's nothing left to cling on to.
I read somewhere this morning that they're 7th bottom in Europe's top 5 leagues for percentage of possession.
Don't need to have the ball all the time, Gregor. We know it's not about that. It's about winning.
Well, look, it's true though. When you know, if you've got a, it's worked for a lot. Again, this is the conflict in the whole voice.
So he doesn't get a contract for you. Doesn't get a contract.
That's
for you.
Not. Come on.
No, come on.
It's worked for a long time, and they've been a success. Moyes' time has been a success, but as we keep coming back to, they need something more.
It can be a success, and he can still not get a contract. So I'm asking, contract for you?
I don't think he will. That's the most important thing.
No, whether he should or not. That's what I'm asking. Come on.
I can see arguments both ways. Oh, I'm sitting totally on the fence here.
So politicians in. Tom, contract for you? It sounds like not.
No, not for me. No, I honestly think there are teams in the Premier League now. They're safe. They're not going to get in the top four. And in the middle, there's this kind of bracket of 5-10 teams. We're seeing it with Palace as well, where they have the money. And let's remember now, West Ham have some good players. That's the difference between last season. They've now got Ward-Prowse, they've got Paqueta, they've got Kudus. These are good attacking players under a more kind of progressive coach, could do something more exciting than this, you know. And ultimately, if you're going to finish somewhere between 7th and 14th every season, then you want to see at least some ambition, some attacking football, some goals, you know. And I think there are a few teams now in the Premier League that are wrestling with this.
Moyes has always said, like, I want to see the team evolve. And to be fair, every time you've asked me this question, you've asked it many times, I said, if Moyes wants to keep his job, he has to do that he has to take that step. He'd be better finishing 14th and playing a more exciting kind of brand of football than finishing in like the Conference League spot again by playing this football. That is more likely to keep him in the job, and he's not doing it.
Still not a yes or no. Alison Rudd, final view from you. David Moyes, contract or not?
I'd give him one. I just don't know why it's necessary to focus on all that's negative about West Ham. When they get a set piece, it's always promising. When they counter-attack, they can be as thrilling on the break as anybody when they want to be. When it clicks, I think they do look quite attractive. So before it all went wrong against Arsenal on Sunday, they were drowning out the first chance from the Arsenal fans. The West Ham fans were singing, you know, champions of Europe, we know what we are. This is something that mattered to them. And you can't know that another manager would have got them that. It was hard work, actually. Gregor knows this better than anyone. It's quite a graft to win a European campaign, especially the Conference League, actually. It's a graft. It's a graft. There's travel, and it's Thursday nights, and it's, you've always got that spectre of how far will it impact the team? Will you go into the relegation places? And to juggle all that, I think, means he deserves a little more respect than we're showing him today.
Gregor didn't win it. He only reported on it. It wasn't that hard.
I know, yeah.
We paid for his flights and everything. What are you on about?
It was etched on his face. It etched on Gregor's face. The hardship.
He wears it well. Didn't get a medal, though. Anyway, moving on to another game that was arguably more thrilling, but with fewer goals. Tottenham-Brighton looked like a cracker on the highlights, Tom Allnutt.
It was a really good game, yeah. I basically thought that it was a match between two teams who were better at pressing than playing out from the back, but they were absolutely determined to play out from the back, you know? It's two sides who just refuse. And, you know, this is admirable, but they obviously have this style of play where they just must play out from the goalkeeper. But they also are both, you know, two of the, you know, best pressing teams in the division, particularly Brighton. You know, they're really, really good at it. You know, the way De Zerbi has them set up. And what happened was they were just repeatedly stealing the ball off each other in the final third. And they had these, series of openings, particularly Tottenham, to be honest, in the first half after Brighton scored. Tottenham just had about half a dozen, maybe, openings where they would nick the ball off Brighton, have the kind of pitch there. Brighton would be near the wrong side of the ball, but they just didn't quite have that quality in the final third. And what it kind of came down to, really, was sort of watching Spurs and, to some extent, Brighton have these, I wouldn't even say chances, but kind of possibility for chances for 90 minutes, but maybe not have quite the quality in that final third to do it. Richarlison, Werner, Kulusevski even for Spurs, and for Brighton, Welbeck, you know, played actually very well, Fatty, but, and then Son comes on the 60th minute and in the 95th with, you know, 10 seconds to go, just delivers that cross, which is absolutely inch perfect with the right pace on it, and Johnson couldn't miss. And that is the difference, you know, between these sort of maybe 7 out of 10 forwards who will run and create things and occasionally score, and a player like Son and Salah, you know, these guys who in the fine margins, you know, with seconds left to play can make the difference.
Can I ask you what the mood was like there when Son came on? Because I think he's just, when I've watched Spurs and he's there, he lights up. He just, it's like someone who walks in the room and you think, oh, I'm glad they've come because they're amazing. I feel like he lights the stadium up. Yeah. But I couldn't tell that off the telly.
No, absolutely. I mean, you could feel the whole occasion really was about Son's return. You know, he's only been away 5 weeks or something. But it was as if he'd been injured for a year. You know, it was this kind of like hero's welcome, you know. And that, there was a sense outside the stadium before kickoff, you know, lots of Son flags everywhere. It felt like there were more South Korean fans than there even are normally. And it was funny because even, I thought Son would start, and I think most people did, but his almost him coming on kind of had a benefit for Spurs because it generated this kind of swell of momentum, you know. And even when it was, you know, it was no coincidence, in my opinion, that Postecoglou called Son over in the 60th minute, and the whole stadium kind of rose, you know, in a kind of sense of anticipation. And it was as the fans were still cheering that Spurs moved the ball out to the right. I think it was Kulusevski who played the ball through for Saar and who then equalised, you know. And it was in that kind of moment of anticipation that Spurs got their equaliser. Now, ironically, in the next 20 minutes after Son came on, Spurs were actually all over the place and Brighton could very easily have won the game. They created two or three really good chances. Probably a draw would have been a fair result.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask. It got the impression watching the highlights that the sense from the kind of commentary was that this was building towards Tottenham turning it around type thing. But it sounds like you're saying that it was actually pretty 50-50 and came down to a moment of brilliance from a top-level player in Son.
Yeah, I mean, I think overall, probably the whole match, I think Spurs probably just about shaded it and probably just about deserved the win. But there was definitely that period after Spurs made a triple substitution where they just lost all their kind of shape and momentum. And that's a funny one because in a way that the two substitutions, it was Son and Johnson, both came on, assist, goal scorer for the winner. But actually for 20 minutes or so, it looked like Postecoglou's substitution has just really killed all the momentum that Spurs had. And Brighton could have won it in those 20 minutes. You know, they played well. I think they would be really disappointed not to have got a point or even to have won the game. But yeah, Son makes a difference. And Spurs are looking good. You know, they've got now Maddison back, Bentancur back, you know, Son back. They've got, I think for the first time under Postecoglou, they've got all their options available. And in my opinion, looking good now.
I think Bentancur's role in that first goal is kind of like...
It's brilliant, yeah.
Yeah, and that sums up. You know, he's almost like the last man. He gets getting the ball, he's trying to turn and beat a player, and then kind of there's a little ricochet. He looked like he was going to lose it, and he kind of bundled his way through, found Kulusevski out wide, and then it was a great through ball. But just like... the bravery to get on the ball there, and that's why it was such a thrilling game. The two teams that play like that, they take it under pressure, particularly players in midfield, like under real danger, and they're asked to do that. I remember I've watched Brighton games this season where Billy Gilmore's been absolutely berated by De Zerbi just because he's not taking the ball on the half turn when there's someone on his shoulder. He's like, I want you, that's what I want you to do. if you lose it, you lose it. And that's what both these coaches do, and it's thrilling.
Mm. Looking further forward, you mentioned, Tom, there, that forward line. I'm interested to know whether, you know, with Son and Maddison and, you know, some of those other players that you maybe outlined, Brennan Johnson, a young player coming through, do they look like they've got enough to build into the team, you know, to the team they want to be for the rest of the season? You know, is the likes of Brennan Johnson, former Lincoln City hero that he is, going to be enough? You know, took his goal very well, but it was ultimately a tap-in, as you say, because of Son's pass. Are players like him and Werner going to be enough for Tottenham, or, you know, is that going to be a problem where they're relying on Son and Maddison still?
They're relying on Son and Maddison, but I think that's enough. You know, if they've got those two there, then I think it's enough. You know, we saw in that first 2 or 3 months of the season when Son and Maddison were playing and they were, you know, really clicking with each other. That's enough for the top 4 or 5. I think where Tottenham, the big question is this enough to kind of take the next step? You know, and you look at the best teams now in the Premier League, but also around Europe. In a way, the most talented players now, the ones that make the difference, aren't so much the kind of number nines and the strikers. It's the wingers. You know, you look at all the best teams. They've got brilliant players who play in the sort of left wing and the right wing, and they score 20 goals and make assists. And I think Spurs, particularly since Son has moved, you know, increasingly down the middle with Kane going to Bayern, they now lack a little bit up there. You know, and if they're going to make that next step, I think they need to improve on those options on Werner. You know, Johnson is a slightly different case. He's young. You know, maybe he's going to explode into the next Gareth Bale. But if they are going to take that next step, I think they need more up there. But in terms of this season, I think it's enough.
Alisson, Brighton, their season, is this kind of game, you know, does it sum up how their season is perhaps progressing? Very much in games. We love to watch them. They make for brilliant, entertaining football for the neutral. But as Tom said, you know, slightly missing that killer instinct in the forward lines and maybe just falling short of where they want to be.
Yeah, I think I just can't help but feel that we're taking Brighton slightly for granted these days. And, you know, when we think how far they've come, I think their priority is going to be Europe. I think they're going to... I know that's not a factor now, this minute, but I think as the season reaches its climax, I think that's their priority. Having watched them in Europe and watched them in the league, there's a difference in energy levels, motivation, sense of it all clicking, and knowing that you can't be everything all the time with relatively limited resources and a team that lost some of its best players. I think what's probably commendable is that they do, under De Zerbi, keep trying to play this thrilling stuff, even when they haven't quite got the personnel or haven't quite prepared in the right way for it. I feel sometimes they push it, and they we'd all excuse them if they had a game where they were quite had like 1% of the passivity that West Ham had, for example. But they don't, and it's almost like it almost feels. Watch, I don't know if you felt this when you were watching them, Tom, but it feels like they really don't mind the loss. It's the nature of it that would matter more to them, which is kind of staggering when you think about it.
I mean, I always, whenever I watch Brighton, more than almost any other team in the league, I think what a difficult team they are to play against, you know. And it's, they're just so well coached, and I know De Zerbi gets a lot of praise from a lot of people, but it's because when you watch them, you almost, the system is working much better than the individual parts. You know, you see all the players and you think, well, you know, this is Welbeck and it's Gilmore, and you know, they're good players, but somehow the team looks so dangerous. You know, they pose so many questions, so many problems, you know. And I agree with you. Like every time you watch them, there's a clear style of play. And not to come back to the Moyes question, but this is a team, you know, where you can see that they're playing above themselves. They're brilliant to watch. They might not win every week because they haven't got the kind of talents of the top six teams, maybe. But it's a really clear style of play.
Well, if you're a Brighton fan and you think we're overrating you, underappreciating you, you can get in touch with me, tom.clark@thetimes.co.uk. Or maybe you've got a topic idea for the upcoming shows. Stick with us, though. Up next, it's the great Scott McTominay debate.
Off Air, the podcast with Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
Keep your cheese in the sink.
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times Radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh,
no.
So
yes. How would that go in the booth?
Badly. It would go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times Radio app.
Welcome back to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. I'm Tom Clark, and today I'm joined by Tom Allnut, Alison Rudd and Gregor Robertson. Up next, he's Scottish, he's 27. He's played 237 times for Manchester United, scoring 27 goals. He's got nearly 50 caps for Scotland. And we still don't know who, what, why or where a Scott McTominay is. Gregor, I'm coming to you first. Your fellow countryman. What is he?
If that makes a difference.
What is he? Yeah, but he might have something in you, ingrained in you, that you can help us explain it. Because he's fascinating. He scored a brilliant goal to win the game for Manchester United against Aston Villa. Timed his run to perfection. Yeah. A bullet header. He could have been a strapping centre forward. But no, he's a confused midfielder who's played in defence for Scotland. He's played in every single position in midfield for Manchester United. And he keeps winning them games.
Yeah.
What is he? Who is he? I don't know.
I don't think anyone knows. I think the one thing is he played more advanced when he was younger.
Right.
I think in his academy days, this is what he was. But I think to get an opening in the team, he had to play a little bit deeper. And for all the world, that's what you thought he would be. You thought he'd be the destroyer rather than the kind of creator or the finisher throughout his career. And here he is with 15 goals in all competitions this season. Seven of which came for Scotland.
So, yeah, listen, this is your chance, mate. Sometimes you have to crowbar it in, but no, this is this is your moment. Because also, you know, it's fascinating to think back to that career, and he also played brilliantly in the right side of a three-man defence for Scotland as well, didn't he? But is he a jack-of-all-trades, or can he now become something, is kind of what I'm getting at, age 27? Or will he forever be the kind of 12th man just filling in gaps everywhere?
You're asking, can he become a kind of a number 10 or like a box crashing midfielder,
or actually
in the
part
Premier League
of
for
Manchester
Man
United's, you know, a three-man midfield for Manchester United?
I don't think so. I think he's not even like Darren Fletcher. Darren Fletcher kind of, there was a period where he did become that, and there was like almost moments, the periods where he was absent with injury or illness, or whatever, everyone realised how good he was. But there are some parallels in that it's like he always got in the team despite everyone else really wanting someone else in the team. And I think that's what Scott McTominay will be while he's at Manchester United. But look, he could have left, and he decided to stay and fight, and was determined to contribute and make a name for himself at Manchester United. And he's doing that, so he deserves great credit. But I think the answer is no. I think there will always be a desire to have Scott McTominay as an extra. Hmm. Rather than the man that you're relying upon.
But there's nothing wrong with that, though.
You might still score 15 goals and play 25 games a season, whatever. He still could have a really positive impact for Manchester United. But the answer's still no.
Hmm. Do we think this is a case of Erik ten Hag deserving a bit of praise? Continuing our theme from last week, compliments for Manchester United. Getting something out of a player, identifying what he can bring to the team, moving him up the field, Alison?
Yes, but I mean, I think it has to be pretty thick not to see that McTominay is very useful if you're a Man United manager. You say that,
but I think for a while he actually embodied the things that they lacked. You know, bloody hell, they're relying on Scott McTominay. And, you know, there were many a night when he would play in a deeper role and would maybe make a mistake, and he would be the embodiment of this team isn't good enough.
Yes, and Ten Hag must be doing something right to keep McTominay willing and able to have cameo parts. But in the match report in the game today, which Henry Winter writes, he says he's not good enough to start for United. Certainly not in midfield, where Kobbie Mainoo and Casemiro build a partnership, nor further forward, where he's got his youngsters now. But that is, I mean, that's presumably why we're discussing this, Tom, because it seems to have become a fact, a fait accompli, that Scott McTominay isn't good enough to start for United. And I wouldn't say it's that definitive at all. Because he has all these qualities and is so versatile and seems to really care for the team and have an affinity with the fans and so on, I would say I would find a way to play him. And I think it's a bit mean that some youngster comes through, Manu comes through in midfield, and suddenly he's the star. I've seen him have a really rubbish game, actually. I've seen him make mistakes. I think McTominay's reliable, not doesn't make mistakes, has the wisdom of his 27 years. I wouldn't say it's definitive that he can't start for United. I think that's a slightly weird path that the club have gone down.
It depends,
and pundits do.
It depends on like the team and the way and the manager and the way they play. Like, you could actually draw some parallels too with John McGinn for Aston Villa. He's not really, you know, your archetypal number 10, but he kind of plays in that role for Villa, and he's a bustler, and he's like, you know, he is creative, but not like in the sort of traditional sense, and he does score goals, but, you know, he's
you can talk about some non-Scottish players as well.
No, yeah. there are some parallels, but like Aston Villa are still a kind of, you know, a team trying to break into the elite. They're not a member of the elite, and that's why, you know, it's Manchester United. It's Fernandes is normally playing number 10, and if it's not Fernandes, then it'll be someone of that ilk, and, you know, who is like, you know, hugely skillful and talented and creative. And McTominay is not that, but he's effective.
I guess part of the reason for my fascination with him as a topic is that in modern football we have these so almost defined roles in the modern game, as much as we shun, you know, there's no formation, it's all free form. We do have, oh, he's a six, he's an eight, he's a 10, etc. And it kind of comes back to, you know, you highlighted Darren Fletcher, and that's interesting. Alex Ferguson's Manchester United squads had lots of these type of players. John O'Shea, for example. Players who were just quite good footballers who could do lots of different jobs at lots of different times for lots of different scenarios. But I was kind of wondering, there aren't that many Scott McTominays that I can think of who do that to a kind of maybe a maximum 8 out of 10 level ever. You know, it's slightly fascinating in this modern game to me, Tom. What do you think?
Well, I wonder if there's a stylistic thing as well, because would Darren Fletcher, for example, play in this Erik ten Hag team in this era of football? You know, because it's almost like goalkeepers where, you know, we sort of a whole batch of very good goalkeepers basically got phased out in the last 10 years because they couldn't kick the ball about with their feet. And you sort of think in midfield now, they're under so much pressure, and it goes back to what we were saying at Brighton with Gilmore, you know, getting the ball basically with someone right behind you. All these teams, like United, are playing under Ten Hag with slightly more kind of progressive, demanding managers about their possession, excuse me, are basically asking their midfielders to be very comfortable on the ball in very tight areas. And McTominay might be a very effective player in a West Ham team, for example. But there are a lot of midfielders, I think, now in the Premier League who are suddenly, you know, 27, 28, they grew up basically playing in a system of 4-2-3-1 where they didn't have to get the ball in these kind of tight areas and play kind of, you know, Pep Guardiola football. And they're a bit like, I haven't got that aspect to my game and you're asking me to do it and I can't. And probably Ten Hag can see that and he thinks, OK, let's get him away from the defence. Let's get him away from that area where he's going to lose the ball and he can actually affect the game, you know. And there are other ones I can think of. Calvin Phillips is a bit like this. Højbjerg at Spurs is like this. You know, they're good players, but they can't do what their coaches are asking them to do. They can't do what this kind of modern era of pressing football requires. And so you've almost got this kind of batch of decent central midfielders who are kind of becoming extinct. You know?
That's a really, really good point. And someone who you would see actually who that change has worked in a positive effect for is Ross Barkley. Because he wasn't really a number 10 in that he, you know, he didn't always come up with the numbers and he didn't always, you know, have the end product. Some of that was to do with his, you know, taking a bad move to Chelsea or whatever. But he looks like, and he played deeper as a kid, and then he broke his leg, and he said to kind of, he was a bit wary about going into tackles and stuff, and then also to get into the team, you know, David Moyes, you're going to put someone a bit more advanced rather than a kind of a defensive role in midfield. Now he's playing deeper, he's got all those attributes, so it's kind of working out better for him. But I agree, there's not really a defined role for him, and that's kind of also why, like, there's some sort of comments about calling him Mick Fellaini on Twitter and stuff, because it's like,
which is done in a mean way.
It feels like a player and playing a role that's from like a decade ago.
Which is done in a mean way, but actually Marouane Fellaini was a brilliantly effective footballer in the Premier League. I mean, one of the beauties of hosting this podcast, listeners, and also being part of the editing team is I get most of my ideas for commission. So Tom, Gregor, you can decide who's going to write the piece about all these modern midfielders that you've just stumbled upon. Manchester United in general then, it's another win, and another win where people go, blimey heck, you've beaten Aston Villa away. It's another step in the right direction for Erik ten Hag, Alisson. But in reality, the performance, bit lucky to win, do we think?
I'm getting deja vu. I mean, this was last season, wasn't it? Mm. They were grabbing wins that they didn't, I hate the word deserve, but if you take the match as a whole, chances created, attractive football played, Aston Villa, you'd say, if they'd won that, no one would argue about it being unfair in any way. Excuse me. But this is exactly what happened to United last season. They managed to get a Champions League spot whilst being talked about as if they were hovering around 17th or 18th. There was a disconnect.
But there is an improvement, isn't there, I would say, on that extreme that you've outlined there. I think the gap between those two things that you've just outlined has narrowed. So, for example, they might finish 5th or 6th whilst occasionally looking like a team who should finish 10th.
In more recent history, yes, they seem to have come through a crisis and they're showing a lot of unity, which we've already discussed on the podcast. I see no reason to go there again. I mean, we can't have a let's praise Ten Hag slot every week, can we? That's ridiculous.
Just a couple of weeks, it's been nice after slagging him off. Aston Villa then, Unai Emery, it's been a bit of a difficult patch, but they're still in and amongst the European places. Is it bad luck? Are they, you know, is it the fatigue? Is it that European campaign kicking in? Gregor?
I think John McGinn, again, let's talk about another Scotsman again. I think he summed up very well afterwards. He was saying that, like, we've had a dip in results and performances in recent weeks, but this one was not a dip in their performance levels. He thought on another day they could have won it, and I think he was right. I also enjoyed his thing about, like, he was saying, as captain, it's about keeping everyone together, but it's easier when you can't understand half the other lads in the changing room. And I think Emery thinks the same as well. They had a lot of really good chances, and Ollie Watkins had an off day in front of goal, which he can't really afford to have too often. So I don't think there's anything to panic about for Villa whatsoever.
And it was a good bounce back from what was a very disappointing performance against Chelsea. Because, you know, Villa fans, they want some. They're not going to win the title. They'd like a bit of glory, a bit of silverware, and they thought they were good enough to win the FA Cup.
And a good response to going behind, you know, to what was, you know, Maguire was bullying. I think it was it Kamara in midfield.
Glad you finally come back on board with the Maguire.
He was bullying them every single set piece and like knocking them down. So to come back from that, and it was a really good response, and they could have won the game. I don't think there's anything to worry about for Villa.
If we're settling in for a three-horse title race, then fourth place, Tottenham, Aston Villa, between the two of them, or are Manchester United going to sneak in, as Gregor Robertson, you actually predicted many months ago? Alison?
Oh, it's a bad day for football if Man United finish above Spurs, isn't it?
But will it happen, though?
Excuse me. Will it happen? Yeah. I mean, it could happen, couldn't it? Because the world's not fair. Well, it's not right, is it?
I need to stop asking you about Manchester United, don't I? Moving on, Tom Allnutt, who's going to finish fourth?
The team that is largely an institution that's largely dysfunctional and trying to find its way with semi-new owners and having underperformed for outlay and just been hugely disappointing, should finish above a team that is being brave and entertaining everybody, even people who don't like Spurs. I have to admit, they're fun.
Yeah, it doesn't answer my question as to who's going to finish fourth. Tom Allnutt might.
I don't think they will. No, I mean, the gap is still there. What is it, 6 points, 7 points now?
Yeah,
six
to Spurs. Do you feel like Tottenham have kind of been through their rocky patch? Because that's the other thing, isn't it, in these seasons, you know, your peaks and troughs, have they kind of gone through their rocky patch?
I think so,
Son,
yeah. They've got the players back now. I think, you know, Spurs are far from perfect and they concede a lot of goals, but I just think they've got a bit more momentum, fluency. I think they're a better team than United. You know, I really do. I mean, United delivered, and, you know, it's United.
And better than Villa overall?
Yes, and I think Villa have got more distractions. Spurs have got nothing else apart from the league now. You know, they're going to play about a 40-game season, Spurs. You know, Villa, I think, could easily go deep in Europe with Emery, and that could make a difference as well.
Gregor, Mr. Predictions, you love it. Who's going to finish fourth?
Yeah, I think if Spurs keep the two most important players fit now, then they will.
Excellent.
But fifth could be enough, right? I mean, they're saying, I think, 80% chance at the moment that fifth is going to be enough for Champions League, so they could all get in.
Very true. Well, speaking of predictions, I gave Arsenal the reverse jinx the other week when I said they were going to get battered by Liverpool, and they now look like they're going to win the title. But speaking of traditional jinxes, Gregor, Luton Town gave them the big hype in the last few shows. Then you went and interviewed their star striker, Adebayo. Mm. And they promptly got walloped by Sheffield United. But first, before we get onto that game, tell us about meeting Elijah Adebayo.
He's a lovely fella. He's, you know, really, really smart and articulate, and had a great journey. And I think he appreciates the journey he's had as well. And, you know, I think he joined Fulham at 8 until he was 21. So he's a huge part of his life. At one club without making a first team appearance, went on loan to Bognor Regis, Slough Town, Cheltenham, Swindon, Stevenage, and then permanently to Walsall. So it was 3 years ago, last month, he was still playing in League 2 for Walsall. and then he joined, and he was really, really kind of clear about what it is that's making the kind of special energy at Luton, is that, you know, yes, Luton have been on a remarkable journey, and they've had players who've been on that, a lot of that journey, but also the guys who've joined them sort of at various stages in League One and the Championship, they've all had the similar sort of journeys. They're kind of, you know, they've had to fight to even get the chance at Luton, and he said he thinks that kind of brings a sort of special unity to the place. And yeah, of course, then they got pumped the next day, so that was ideal.
But, you said he seemed like a very bright lad as well.
Yeah, he's just, I don't know, really articulate and seemed very well brought up, and he was, you know, he said some nice things about his mum and what she kind of had to do for him when they were young, and then he moved into Diggs with a family in near Fulham, changed school when he was 14 and stuff, and he was with his family, lived with his family for 5 years, and he's godfather to their fourth child. Just a really nice guy, and someone who I think everyone would really pleased to see. There's so many players like this in Luton, at Luton, who have this story, similar kind of story, and he's another one, and he's been in great form up until the weekend.
Okay. Why did he say he didn't make it at Fulham? What was the reason that he felt that there?
Well, he actually, interestingly too, he was moved to centre half when he was 14, and he spent about 3 years at centre half, and then Peter Grant, once of Celtic, was his coach, I think, in the under 21s or 23s, and they asked him the question when he was about to move up to that age group, right, what do you want to be? And he said, I want to be a striker. And so that's when they said, right, go on loan. He went to Slough Town and Bognor Regis and stuff. And he said there was one game where Fulham had no fit strikers, and he thought, right, so I should get on the bench or whatever, and he wasn't. And he thought, right, that's it. And he from that point, he realised, I need to go and do this somewhere else. But while I'm doing this, I need to show that I'm good enough to play at a higher level, but I need to show that at a lower level. And a lot of that's about getting back to the same sort of environment where, you know, it makes it easier for you to excel. It's not easy to go. He said he went his first game at Slough Town, he didn't remember it for the hat-trick. He remembered it for turning up and not having brought a drink. And no one provided drinks for him, so he was like, he was thirsty at this game. That's what he said. That was a real eye-opener for him. But yeah, he had to work really hard to get this opportunity.
Don't provide drinks for this podcast either.
I know. Well, really poor. I've offered to provide the coffees, but no one takes me up on it.
Blimey, heck, Alison Rudd's in a bad mood again. Quick, moving on. She's going to swear at me in a minute. It sounds like you were very fond of him and massaged his ego sufficiently on Friday afternoon. That meant he took his eye off the ball and Sheffield United waltzed in and got the win. And I wanted to talk about an item in Tony Cascarino's column, talking about Chris Wilder. He says, I know Chris Wilder a bit, which is a bit of an understatement because he knows him very well, doesn't he, Alan? And one thing I can guarantee is that Sheffield United are going to chase wins in every game from now on to the end of the season. It means they may be on the end of some hidings, but Chris will never be a manager who lets them sit in for a point. They're going to be the great entertainers, having been the kind of, you know, the whipping boys all season, Alison.
Yeah, well, why not? Because that's how they were successful the first time around in the Premier League under Chris Wilder. They were brave. You know, they played a strange system where the centre-backs became wing-backs and you never knew where anyone was going to be on the pitch, and they were fearless. And Tony Cascarino is spot on. I mean, what is the point? There is literally no point now in wanting a point, because it's not going to save you. The only way, and it's a long shot, the only way they could possibly avoid relegation is to grab wins that are unlikely but not impossible if you are brave enough. They don't really have on paper the players to do it, but as they showed against Luton, if you just go for it now and again, it'll come off. And it's, you know, mathematically it makes more sense, doesn't it, to grab 3 points than have a couple of draws. So
certainly does.
It.
That's how my dad always used to make me feel better about Lincoln getting beat. He said, if we win next week, it's more points
it's
than
more
two.
Points.
Trust.
It means more. It means
from
more.
The bottom of the Premier League to the top of the Bundesliga, and we finish with poor old Harry Kane. Might not win another title.
You God. Say that, but you're smiling, Tom.
God. No, but it's because I'm a mean editor and I like these narratives that get us talking. Pesky editors. James Gearbrand, if Liverpool had any doubts about Xabi Alonso, they shouldn't now. Cold, methodical Spaniard is very different to Jurgen Klopp, but Bayer Leverkusen's resounding 3-0 victory over Harry Kane's Bayern Munich showed he could be the sport's next great coach. Tom and Orman, agree?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I guess the question for him is what is the right next move and what is the right timing? And I suspect if...
Wait for a bigger club than Liverpool for me.
I suspect if Bayer Leverkusen beat Bayern Munich to the title, then that is a good way to go out, you know? And they played brilliantly. Like, they deserved it. You know, they really deserved it. I mean, Xabi Alonso's got everything right. And I think, in a way, Liverpool would be smart to go now before other teams do, because they're going to be two or three teams.
Maybe Bayern Munich.
Maybe Bayern Munich, yeah. Real Madrid.
Yeah, that'd be classic Bayern Munich, wouldn't it? Just nick the bloke who always beats them to something.
Yeah, and poor Harry Kane, yeah. I mean, he must be really cursing his luck, right? I mean, you know, the 1 year when he thought he'd be sort of guaranteed a title. But to be fair to Kane, he can't do any more. You know, he scored about 25 goals in about 10 games, hasn't he? So, I mean, it's nothing on him, in my opinion. I mean,
or everyone... is it? Is he just a bad luck charm, ultimately?
Goodness me.
Yeah, I mean, there's still the Champions League, you know? I mean, there is still the league. You know, it's not gone for Bayern. But I think they'll be there in the Champions League as well. And ultimately, you know, it is, of course, about winning trophies for Kane. It is, but I think it's also about being there, you know, and this is the thing about Tottenham is that they were never kind of in that race. Okay, they got to the Champions League final, fine. But in general, Kane wants to kind of be in those races where a trophy is possible, and you can't say that's not the case now.
Some of the patterns of play and stuff from Leverkusen are incredible to watch. It's like, you know, you see kind of analysis where like they highlight three players in a triangle and like join the triangle up. And watch them move around the pitch. It's almost like watching that in real life. Some of the times they're kind of like overloads on the right hand side and players just playing in little triangles but progressing up the pitch with it. It's like...
They make you excited about the idea of Alonso coming to the Premier League?
Yeah, and as James also kind of highlighted in his piece, it's like seems to be a degree of flexibility to it as well. They ceded a lot of possession in this game, whereas clearly, normally, they don't do that. They had 39% of the ball. Some of that will be game state, but... They went with a game plan, and as James outlined, it sort of it was different. It was surprising. Even the team he named was surprising. Nathan Teller, who's really stepped up in recent weeks, he scored. I think he'd scored 3 and 3 before this game, and he started to make an impact in the team. Who, you know, he was big in the Championship for Burnley last season, for earning a move from Southampton. So, yeah, he sprung a few surprises, and it looked like he outthought Tuchel, which is pretty exciting.
Alison Rudd, it's been a difficult show for you. The Jilly Cooper snub at the start, then me making you talk about Manchester United. I'll let you have the final word. Your plea for Xabi Alonso to the Liverpool board. Make him the offer now.
It's looking good, isn't it? I mean, what struck me in what people have written, and James Gearbrand in particular, is that they make the point he's very different to Klopp, and I think that's a really good thing. You don't want to succeed Klopp and be Klopp light. You don't want to be a version of Klopp. He's nothing like Klopp at all. He's quieter, not very demonstrative, not terribly emotional, and he's more analytical. He's unlikely to be the sort of chap where every press conference is every word is just worth reporting, goes off on tangent. He's not going to do that. He's going to be a serious, quiet personality, and I think the only way you can... Because if I were him, I'd be thinking, yeah, I'd love to manage Liverpool. I don't think I want to go straight after Klopp. But for him, it might just work simply because he is so different that the comparisons will stop.
The squad as well is maybe ripe for a manager like him, with a lot of young players coming through as well.
Well, if he can continue that golden touch where he can bring through players that no one's really expecting too much of and make them coagulate into something that can... beat Bayern Munich so easily, then yes, then, and I think he would enjoy working with Liverpool's excellent academy as well. So it's easing that moment when it's going to happen, goodbye Klopp. But how fortunate that he seems to be in pole position. It's good.
Almost got the smile back on your face, Alison Rudd. What a huge relief. Tom Allnutt, Alison Rudd and Gregor Robertson, thank you very much for joining me. Thank you too for listening. We'll be back on Thursday with Johnny Northcroft, and we'll make sure to ask him all about Jilly Cooper.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.